Biblical Faith was presented by Ron Julian on August 10, 2006, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
My task is to talk about the Bible's view of faith. Let me start by making a comment about, for myself, about why this question about faith and science, faith and reason, is an interesting question to me. I am encountering in my culture all the time people who are telling me that faith is a defective way of knowing, that science is different and science is better. And, you know, I mean, in the political arena and in the educational arena, I mean, these messages are there all the time. And yet the Bible's telling me that my eternal destiny depends on whether or not I have. So my life may or may not be personally touched by issues like evolution or intelligent design, that kind of stuff. Sometimes if we're the sort of people that are particularly combative, we really enjoy getting in there and arguing these points with people. But in the end, winning those arguments is not the point, ultimately. But the fact is, I'm living in a world where, and I was trying to think of all of the different politicians, scientists, reporters, educators, actors. I mean, I get it from every direction. Are giving me this picture of what's cool and what's not. You know, what's acceptable, what's a superior way of approaching life and what's an inferior way. And more or less consistently, they're telling me that science tells us the truth and faith tells us fairy tales. And it's fine if you want to believe your little fairy tales as long as you don't get out in the real world and cause trouble for us intelligent people. I mean, it's basically, you know, they pat us on the head and say, you go ahead and believe that the dew on the ground at night comes from little fairies who are crying because the sun is gone. That's a pretty little story. But meanwhile, we're going to get in there and we're going to examine atmospheric pressure and, you know, the dew point and all of these intelligent scientific kind of things. The very thing that the Bible tells me is most important, faith, they dismiss as irrelevant and kind of disreputable. I mean, that's just not the way intelligent grown-ups conduct their lives. So that's the thing that's sort of interesting to me. How do I put together the emphasis in the Bible on faith with the idea that somehow that's a disreputable, unintelligent way to approach life? My topic today, though, is to talk a little bit about what the Bible has to say about faith. Now, I just have to be clear right from the beginning. I have a focus here. There are all sorts of things that the Bible could say about faith. I mean, this is a huge topic in the Bible. Are we justified by faith alone? What is the relationship between faith and works? What is the relationship between faith and the law? There's a million things that we could talk about, and they're all very important theological questions that have a lot of impact on how we think of our lives and our relationship with God. But I just want you to understand that's not the topic today. That's, you know, justification by faith and faith and works and all of that stuff, that's not what we're here to talk about. What we're interested in today are some aspects of faith as a way of knowing. What sort of a thing is it when I'm being asked to have faith? What is it and why is it important? Why would the Bible call on me to do that? And is that a position that has integrity? I mean, why would a reasonable person think that having the kind of faith that the Bible is talking about is a good thing to do? And in fact, the way that I ought to know the world. We've seen a number of examples already from the Gospels and Hebrews and Romans This afternoon, I want to try to step back and sort of get a bigger picture. So you understand, I just want to repeat again, there are a million things I could talk about. I have chosen to take a certain tack here with this question. And I hope this tack is helpful to our topic this week. At any rate, this is the tack I have chosen to take, and we'll see if it gets us anywhere. I want to start with a famous statement in the end of the Gospel of John, where John tells us why he wrote the book. "But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Okay, here we have a very simple statement about biblical faith. We are called to believe that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus is the Messiah, another way of putting it, and the result of our believing will be eternal life. On the one hand, this makes sense with some of the things that we've seen already, like what we saw in Habakkuk. My righteous one will live on account of his faith. It is faith that marks the person that God is pleased with. Paul appeals several times to the story of Abraham and how God made promises to him, and he believed those promises, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Paul sees that as a crucial statement from the Old Testament, again, defending the idea that faith is important. God sees faith as that mark of those people that are his. And the one who has this faith will live. But, okay, so on the one hand, it makes a certain amount of sense. On the other hand, though, this idea that we have to believe that Jesus is the Christ to be saved raises some questions. I mean, I know I have encountered this as a young Christian. I encountered this attitude. Isn't it kind of weird that God is determining my eternal destiny based on whether I believe a certain historical fact? I can remember someone complaining as a young Christian, and I didn't know what to say at the time. He said, "This doesn't make any sense. What if I told you, you'll be saved if you believe the earth is flat? What are you going to do about it? If you don't believe the earth is flat, how are you going to go about believing that the earth is flat? You're just going to make yourself, 'I believe that the earth is flat.' No, you don't. You're just saying that. You don't really believe that. So, isn't it weird? I mean, you will be saved if you believe that in 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. What does that have to do with anything? And then there's this other problem. Why that particular fact? Why is my eternal destiny dependent on what I believe about Jesus? Why did God make it that way? So why would my belief about any particular fact affect my eternal salvation? And more importantly, why that one? What is it that's at stake? What is this faith that I'm being asked to exercise here? Okay, so in order to answer these questions, I want to start with my own. I just want to paint a picture of my own before we look at some passages here. Imagine that there was no sin in the world, that we were all born righteous human beings. We were all born like Jesus. Every one of us had the same moral character that Jesus has. No one has that evil inclination that Romans 1 describes, where we refuse to acknowledge that God is God. So, as a child growing up in that world, I would gladly accept all evidence for everything that is true. I'm taking things in, and I would see that apples fall from the tree to the ground, and I would come to believe that there is some sort of a process here that we call gravity by which things fall to the ground. And I would see, on whatever terms that Romans 1 means to suggest that it's true, I would see that God is the creator of the world and is powerful and good, and I would come to believe in him. And if you're 6 feet tall, I would believe that you're 6 feet tall, and I would believe that God keeps his promises, and, you know, on and on. There would be no distinction. I mean, there would be a whole series of things that I say, I believe them. And why do I believe them? Well, because they have compelled I have seen compelling evidence that they are true in one way or another. And I would accept it all. The truths about God, the truths about myself as a creature of God, my obligations to God, the whole thing. But that's not the world I live in fact. Each of us instead is morally corrupt, such that we do not want certain truths to be true. This is what we saw in Romans 1. We are self-centered. At the heart of it, we want to be the center of the universe. I don't want God to be at the center of the universe, and I don't want you to be at the center of the universe. I want me to be at the center of the universe. So, because of that, there are certain truths that we filter out, things that we conveniently find implausible, and even though they're true, we will not take them in. So, that's what we saw in Romans 1. My first point, then, is I think that the kind of faith or belief that the Bible is concerned with has to do with those truths that human beings willfully suppress and filter out. If you compare the world of no sinners and the world filled with sinners, it's the stuff that this group of sinners filtered out that they didn't want to know about God and themselves. That's the stuff that that biblical faith is concerned with. It is concerned with us overcoming our hostility to the big truths about God and instead accepting them. Depends on how you think about it. In one sense, we could say that faith means simply belief in the truths of God. I believe in God. I believe what God says. I have faith. And that's true. In one sense, we could think of faith just in those terms. I mean, the Bible often speaks in that way, as John did. Believe that Jesus is the Christ. But in another sense, faith must be a profound personal revolution of the heart. The world around me refuses to see that God is who He is, that I stand in relationship to Him the way I do, that I need what I need from Him, and so on. The world around me refuses to see it. But as a believer, I do not refuse to see it. I am willing to see that it is true. The people around me do not want the truth to come in and shake up their lives, but I am willing to let it shake up my life because I know it is true. And sometimes this can get very crass. It just comes to mind. When I was not a believer in my teenage years, when I talked to Christians about Christianity, I would be quite frank sometimes. I don't really have any room for a God to come along and tell me what to do. I have my own plans. I'm not interested in that. I mean, I was quite upfront about it. I don't want that. Well, that's kind of our problem. None of us really want that. When we understand our basic problem, that is, how hostile we are to the big truths about God and ourselves, I think then we can understand why believing that Jesus is the Christ is the central issue that it is. It seems like a simple message on the surface, but in fact it confronts us with every one of those big issues about God and ourselves, those big issues that by nature we want to deny. So, the picture that I have of faith is, first of all, in terms of our topic, it is not irrational. It is, in fact, turning away from my irrational hostility to the truth. To become a person of faith means to stop resisting the truth about who I am and who God is and all of those things that by nature I do not want to know. That's why faith is significant, because it is a profound revolution of my heart that I am actually coming to accept that which I rejected before. But even more so, this gospel message about Jesus in particular is like that message that is crafted to hit me in all of those places where I have to confront the truth that I haven't wanted to confront. So what I'd like to do for a while here is to give you some examples of what I mean by that, how the gospel message, Jesus is the Christ, basically, and its related ideas, how in fact what happens when I'm asked to believe that message is I am asked to confront those very issues that I have been unwilling to bow to God in. I have been unwilling to see God for who He is and myself for who I am, and so on. That it is the message Jesus is the Christ that confronts me with those issues in a powerful way. So that for me to actually fully invest myself in the belief Jesus is the Christ and I am going to live in the light of that being true, I'm going to live as if that is indeed true, to do that is to have to confront some profound issues that every human being has to confront. And this is why faith is a significant thing. It is not irrational, but it is a confrontation with those things that I most want to avoid. So let me tell you, give you some examples of what I mean by that. First of all, to believe that Jesus is the Christ, I have to admit that God exists. This may seem fairly obvious, but remember what Hebrews says. The one who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. This is one of the first things that is necessary. If I am going to ultimately find life from God, I've got to admit that He's there. Remember how Romans 1 showed us this perverse desire that we have to suppress the knowledge of the true God. I don't want to admit that God made me, that I owe Him my gratitude and my obedience. I want to be my own man. Now, it's an interesting fact that the Bible itself has very little to say about the mere issue of God existing. If I tried to think of where this is an issue, and it's the Hebrews passage where it says you have to believe that God is, and there's the Romans passage that says we suppress this knowledge of that God is. And then when you start to find it after that, it's hard to find many passages that address that issue explicitly. And I think that's because atheism as an option was not a particular popular option with the people that we're talking to here about here. The issue wasn't whether God exists. The issue was what sort of a God is He? What is His nature? Or who are the gods? Or what does He want from me? And remember, when the pagans in Romans 1 reject the true God, they don't become atheists. They turn to false idols. So it's not the idea that there is some sort of deity that the Bible is very interested in pushing, because most of its readers are not disputing that question. The question is, who is He and what should I do about it? Well, hopefully it's obvious that I can't really believe in any significant sense that Jesus is the Messiah without believing in God. Who's the Messiah? The Anointed One, the King of God's eternal kingdom, the one who is sent by God, the one who is God incarnate. If there is no God, then there's no content to the statement Jesus is the Christ. I mean, we're saying Jesus is the one sent by God to accomplish God's purposes. So if you're going to buy that Jesus is the Christ, you have to buy that there is God. And as we've seen, that is not an easy thing to buy. Not the God of the Bible, not the God who is there. Not the holy God that I must do business with. I have to accept that God in order to accept that Jesus is the Christ. Okay. So, there is one aspect of my hostility to the truth that must be overcome in order for me to have this faith in Jesus. Okay? Now let me pick another one. To believe that Jesus is the Christ, I have to admit that I am evil and worthy of God's judgment. Think of the parable of the Pharisee and the tax gatherer. They're both praying. Who went home accepted by God? Not the Pharisee. The Pharisee thanks God. God, thank you for making me such a great guy. Thanks that I'm not like that repulsive tax gatherer over there. The tax gatherer prays, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus says, it is the tax gatherer who went home right with God. So there is this fundamental idea in the Bible that a key truth that I have to come to terms with, that I am resistant to come to terms with, is there is something wrong with me. I am in the wrong. I have acted in the wrong. I have thought in the wrong. My motives and desires have been in the wrong, and I need mercy. Well, the message that I am a sinner who needs mercy is fundamental to the gospel message, because at the center of the gospel is the cross. Jesus is the Messiah. To believe that, I have to buy this thing that he is the sort of Messiah that he came to be. What did he come to do as Messiah? Did he come to say, hey, you guys are great. I just wanted to show up and say I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm out of here for a while, but hey, keep it up. No, he came to die on a cross, and he came to die on a cross because without some sort of intervention on God's part, on our behalf, we stand liable to the judgment of God. Peter, 1 Peter 2, he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. That's the kind of Messiah that Jesus came to be. Well, is that a message that is offensive to us by nature? Absolutely. Paul says, for the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. This idea that the Messiah had to come and die on the cross for my sins makes no sense to the opponents of the gospel. That's not even, why would such a thing be necessary? That's the problem that the Judaizers had. The Judaizers were a group of Pharisees who had become Christian believers. They accepted the idea, supposedly, that Jesus was the Christ. I mean, if you asked them if was Jesus the Christ, they would have said yes. But, unfortunately, they had the wrong idea of what kind of Christ he came to be. To them, it was obvious that God accepted them because they kept the law. God gave the law. They're keeping the law. That's why God's happy with us. And to cap off our obedient pursuit of the law, the Messiah came and we said, yes, you're the Messiah. We kept the law and we said, Jesus, you're the Messiah, so we did it right. You Gentiles who are not keeping the law cannot expect for God to be happy with you until you join us in keeping the law. So I would argue that in a book like Galatians, which is taking on that issue, Paul is confronting us with the fact that to think somehow that God's acceptance of me is based on my performance of the law or of anything is to entirely miss the point that there is nothing I can do to perform well enough to earn God's favor. The cross is the solution to the problem of my being right with God, not my obedience. So, we see again that to come to a true belief in Jesus as the Christ, we have to confront another of these truths that we don't want to confront, the humiliating truth that we are evil and unworthy of God's favor. So there again, believe this thing, Jesus is the Messiah, and there are these big issues that you're having to confront to do that. Here's another one. To believe that Jesus is the Christ, I have to admit that I have valued the wrong things. And I need to value the right things. I need to pursue what Jesus calls the true riches. Let me start with the parable of the sower for this one. You may remember Jesus compares the proclamation of the gospel to the sowing of seeds. So the sower, the one who is proclaiming the gospel message, he proclaims it to a whole bunch of different people, and it's like the sower who is putting seed on different kinds of ground. One of the kinds of ground that is mentioned is the shallow, rocky soil. And when the sun comes out, the seed in the shallow, rocky soil is scorched by the sun, and it doesn't have a deep root, and so it dies. And Jesus says that this is analogous to the person who is interested in the gospel at first, but when persecution arises, they fall away. They don't have a deep-rooted interest enough in the gospel to survive the heat of the sun. When the heat is on, they're out of there. In other words, when push comes to shove, they couldn't believe the gospel, because they valued comfort and freedom from suffering now more than they valued a future inheritance in the kingdom of God. They wanted something else that the gospel wouldn't give them, and so ultimately they couldn't believe this gospel. They would have been happy to believe it if it didn't involve that. If they could have had what they wanted and believed it, hey, great. But it involved actually having to decide that there was something more valuable than being comfortable now. Likewise, he talks about the seed that falls on the ground with the thorny plants that are already growing up in this ground. And this is analogous to the person who has other things in their life that compete with the gospel, that ultimately choke it out. As Jesus describes it, they have the worries of the world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things. So, although in theory the gospel might seem interesting at first, ultimately there are things in the world that are making me a better offer, is from my perspective, than what I'm getting in the gospel. I value something else more than what it is I'm being offered in the gospel, and so in the end I don't end up sticking with a belief in this gospel. I think a very interesting example of this, I'm not exactly sure why I find this so interesting, but I do, is in John 5:39, Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees about the fact that the Messiah is standing right in front of them and they can't see him. I mean, if you picture, here's Jesus. He is the Christ, the Messiah. He's talking to these guys who spend their lives poring through the scriptures, studying about the Messiah and thinking, when is he going to come and how's this going to work? And he's standing right there in front of them. And so Jesus says to them, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. And it is these that bear witness of me. And then he says this very interesting thing. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God? That's a fascinating statement. He's saying, how can you believe? It's no wonder that you don't believe that I'm the Messiah, because you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God. You're looking for something different than what it is I'm here to offer. You want glory from men. You want glory from each other. You want it now. Right now in this life, I want the reward of having people thinking, you're great. Oh, you're hot stuff. And you know, the problem is, if you follow me, you might end up in a situation where a lot of people think you're not hot stuff. But in the end, what you will receive is glory from God, the real glory. He will praise you as one who had faith in him, and he will bring you into a glorious life, where your life will be filled with glory. But why don't you believe in me? Because you're looking for that first kind of glory and not the second kind. Jesus is saying there, you can't even believe in me because you're set on something different. You want something different. So in order to believe in Jesus as the Christ, I have to put aside my foolish worldly values and admit that the true riches are found in the kingdom of God. You know, what is it I really need? I need to be forgiven for my sins. I need to be rescued from death. I need to be rescued from sin. I need to be rescued from futility. I need to come to fully know God and to be rescued from the sort of decay in my soul that makes me have problems with you and makes me have problems with myself and makes me have problems with my God. I need to be rescued from all of that. And that's what Jesus has ultimately promised to do. But is that interesting to me or not? Is that what I want or not? Ultimately, if that's not what I want, then there's nothing in the gospel that's really going to be all that interesting to me. And so I'm not going to believe it in any significant sense. One last example. To believe that Jesus is the Christ, I have to admit that God is good and trustworthy. Remember what Hebrews said. The one who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. It is not foolish of me to turn to God, to look for my salvation and rescue from God, to look for the fulfillment of my life to God because He is good. He is faithful. He keeps His promises. He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Now, I was thinking about this. It's not at all uncommon to hear all sorts of people who are not necessarily Christian by any stretch of the imagination saying something like, oh, I believe in a God of love. I believe in a God who loves everybody and does nice things, and he just wants to give everybody a big hug and tell them that everything's okay. Well, so is that what I mean? Does that person believe in a God who is good and trustworthy? Well, no, I wouldn't say so in any ultimately meaningful sense, because the true test of our attitude toward God in this regard comes in the midst of those times when things are not so good. I mean, this is the theme that the Bible explores over and over again. God takes us through difficult times sometimes, and He says to us, if you hang in there with me, if you trust me, if you follow me, if you continue to see this as what you need in your life, the salvation that Jesus came to bring is exactly what you need and will ultimately be yours. Stick with me and ultimately the problem will be solved. But is there any guarantee that right now the problem is going to be solved? No, there is not. So, in this connection, I think of the parable of the unjust judge. Jesus tells a story of a widow who is seeking justice. She has an opponent, and she is going to the judge looking for justice from her opponent. The judge, however, is an evil man. He doesn't care anything about her. He doesn't care anything about justice, and he keeps saying, no, get lost. Ultimately, she keeps going back, and the judge decides, I'm tired of this. I'm going to give her what she asked for, finally. Now, what is Jesus doing in this story, and why am I bringing this up? I think Jesus is telling this story because He sees us to be in the same situation in a funny kind of way. Not that the judge that we're dealing with is evil. God is not evil. But God is, in fact, responding to our cries to Him, oftentimes with what seems to be the answer, no. We're looking for the ultimate rescue and deliverance. We're looking for justice. We're looking for God's people to be vindicated. We're looking for the wicked to no longer prosper. We're looking to feel like we have arrived at what God has promised for in the redemption of the world. And yet, sometimes it just seems to keep going on. And then maybe even it gets worse than it was before. So, how are we going to respond? Well, I think Jesus is saying, given what we know about the character of God, what I ought to know about the character of God, I ought to know that God is the sort who cares deeply for justice and He cares about His people. So this widow kept going back to a guy that didn't even give a rip about justice or about her or anything. And yet ultimately he said yes. So how much more sense does it make that we would keep going back to God when we know how deeply He is concerned to redeem His creation, to rescue His people? Now, Jesus says an interesting thing at the end of the parable. When the Son of Man returns, will He find faith on the earth? And I think what He's getting at is, the fact is that God's ultimate answer to our prayers for vindication, for justice, for things to be right, His ultimate answer to those prayers is not going to be in this life. It's going to be when Jesus comes back and establishes His kingdom. It is when the Son of Man returns that everything will be set right. But what He's asking is, when God finally and decisively answers the prayers of His people for vindication and justice and redemption, will there be anyone left who's still expecting Him to come? Will there be anyone left who still believes that Jesus is going to come and fulfill the promises of God? If I'm right about what's happening there, and I think I am, we see again this connection. Why is it that a person at the end would be there believing that Jesus is indeed the Messiah who will come and fulfill God's promises, that they haven't given up, but they're still expecting him to come. Jesus is the Messiah, and I know he is going to fulfill the promises of God. Why would they still be doing that? Well, Jesus says it's because I have an understanding of the character of God. I can count on God to keep his promises. So though it may seem a while in coming, the fact is God is going to do what he said he was going to do. And that's why I would be there believing that Jesus is the Messiah come to fulfill God's promises when he in fact does that. So again, just another example of how my faith, my belief in this idea that Jesus is the Messiah, is the Christ, is tied to another issue that I have to confront in myself. That when I'm encountering the seeming delay of God and the difficulties in the world, I nonetheless hold fast to the idea that God is good and can be counted on. What I've tried to paint in these examples is this picture that the reason that faith is significant, believing these things about Jesus is significant, is because to come to a meaningful faith in the gospel story about Jesus means that I have essentially repented of my hostility to the truth. I am not resisting the idea that God is God. I am not resisting the idea that I am evil and I need mercy from God. I'm not resisting the idea that there is something more valuable than whatever riches I can get a hold of in this world. I'm not resisting the idea that even in the face of the sufferings of this world, God is to be trusted. He deserves my trust and my faithfulness to him. Those are big deals. Those are personal moral issues at the most fundamental level in my life. Am I going to acknowledge the truth of these things? Am I going to submit to them? Am I going to invest my life in the truth of them such that I'm counting on God? I really am counting on God. If you tell me, if you keep believing in this God stuff, I'm going to take away all this wonderful stuff, I would have to say back, well, go ahead and take it, because I believe in the God who has promised me life, and the life that he has promised is what I want. Okay, so this belief, this saying yes to this idea that Jesus is the Christ and that he died for my sins and all of that kind of stuff, is actually, in fact, a profound, fundamental revolution of my heart. Now, I have a couple of comments to make. First of all, this has been said several times now, but I just want to make it clear. Our critics say that in order to come to Christian faith, you must ignore and throw away reason and rationality. You just have this faith that's based on nothing. The biblical picture is quite different. Christian faith is compelling and reasonable. Believing that God exists is reasonable. Believing that the Bible is the Word of God and that the promises of God will stand is reasonable. But in order to see this, we must throw away our irrational hostility to the truth about God and ourselves. It has an intellectual component to it, but fundamentally it's a question of my will. Will I submit to the truth? Will I choose a different path because I have recognized that's not true? The way I was going there is not true. This is true. Christian faith is about invisible and intangible things, but that is not what makes it hard to come by. The virtues of faith are not that we're believing in stuff that you can't see. There are good reasons to believe in those invisible things. The problem is that we don't want them to be true. And that's the significance of Christian faith, that we have come to want the truth to be true. Okay? A second comment. The Bible is not saying that the mere act of believing is in itself a virtue. It's not just faith. You know, I don't know if you've noticed this. I don't watch a lot of network television, but if I ever do, it's amazing how often some story will be about how somebody's got to have faith. Having faith is a good thing. And what that means is, I know things look bad, but just believe they're going to get better. And you will bring it about through imagining that it's the case or something like that, you know. As if that's the virtue. The virtue is looking at the reality of some problem and saying, I don't believe in that problem. It's going to go away. That's faith. Well, the Bible is not indicating in any way that there's any virtue in that. We can believe really stupid things through that method. And in fact, there's no necessary virtue in believing the right things if you're believing them for evil reasons. There's the example of Simon the magician in the book of Acts, who is described as having come to a belief in Jesus. But in the end, it becomes clear he had this great reputation as a magician all around, and everybody admired him for his great powers and what he was called the great power of God or something like this. So he looked at the disciples and the miracles they were doing, and he said, hey, if I paid you some money, would you give me that power so I could do that? And Peter essentially curses him. And he says, you've got nothing to do with us. May you perish with your money. Because although he believed in Jesus, what he really wanted is he saw Jesus as a ticket to getting some power that he could use to make himself a name in his culture. There's no virtue in that kind of belief. It's not the very fact of saying Jesus is the Christ. I check off the yes box on that question, and that makes it good. As I've been saying, faith is that fundamental recommitment, that repentance over my hostility to the truth and saying, I submit. This is, in fact, the way it is. Okay. I probably should... This is a little bit tangential to the point here, but it probably should be said. The role of the Holy Spirit in all of this is crucial, but it does not bypass reason. And let me tell you what I mean. What I think about is, I don't know if you've ever had the experience with the Mormon missionaries. You talk to them, and there's sort of half-baked arguments about why you ought to think that Jesus showed up in South America. And when you start to ask questions about problems with the Book of Mormon and stuff, you don't really want to go there. But what they tell you is, just go ask God to reveal to you that it's true. If you sincerely ask God to reveal to you that this is true, he will. Now, I would argue that although that sounds good, I mean, and I suppose if someone were to sincerely go to God and say, to ask him, God, I want to know what you think is true, I have no reason to think that God might ultimately show them that the Book of Mormon is full of it and then you go someplace else. But you see the move they're making. I mean, ultimately, when it comes right down to it, Mormonism, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but it's just the case, as far as I'm concerned, is it's not all that intellectually compelling. It doesn't really hold up very well as a system. But it's very compelling as a cultural phenomenon. The families treat each other nice, and it's attractive to be a part of that. So that just ask God and let him show you whether it's true is basically, let's bypass this question of whether we can rationally defend this thing as being true, and let me just tell you, you know, just ask God and he'll let you know. Well, I would argue that that's not the way we ought to picture what the Spirit is doing in the lives of believers when it comes to the faith that we come to. The Spirit of God is sanctifying our hearts, cleansing us of our hostility to the truths about God. It's not that those truths are not compelling and reasonable and defensible, but the problem is that we are rebels and we don't want the truth to be true. We can't see it because we're so confused by our own hostility to the truth. For example, and I'm just going to, without going into the passage, I'm just going to tell you what I think it's saying for the sake of time here. But in 1 Corinthians, Some of the Corinthians thought that Paul was basically a hick. I mean, he was just not an impressive person. He was an unimpressive and unsophisticated speaker. They were embarrassed by him. And I would argue that what they wanted was, they wanted Paul to speak in such a way that the important people, the movers and the shakers, the hip people would hear him and say, wow, that guy's impressive. We want Paul to be that kind of guy, you know, we can bring our non-Christian friends, you got to hear this guy, he will blow you away, you know. And he wasn't doing that. And they were saying, you know, we're really not very interested in Paul. Paul doesn't have this quality that we have come to value that we would call wisdom. He just doesn't have it. Well, Paul's answer to them was, look, it can't be done. I can't make the gospel attractive and hip to everybody without taking out the most important parts. Because the gospel, by its very nature, is offensive. It calls upon you to repent of deep-seated ideas about what you want to be true about the world and yourself and about God. And then the way he puts it is, the natural man, the man, and by that he means the man whose heart has not been sanctified by the Spirit of God, cannot correctly evaluate the gospel. You're never going to have the situation where the natural man is going to hear the gospel and say, oh, that's great. I think that's really swift. In order to make the gospel seem cool to someone like that, you'd have to preach a different gospel. It is the spiritual person, however, he says, the person in whom the Spirit is at work, who can evaluate the gospel correctly, can look at it and say, yes, that's true, that's important, that's what I need to invest my life in. So, the picture that's being painted, I would say, is not that the Spirit is bypassing our minds, but rather the Spirit is making it so our minds can be freed from the corruption of our hearts. Now, again, let me remind you of the things I was saying earlier today. I do not mean to suggest that coming to faith is like doing a math problem. You know, we'll put together the pieces of evidence and then I'll believe. That's not the way our minds work. It is a very rich process that involves a lot of things that I might not be able to articulate. And what usually happens is we become believers in ways that we don't really understand and couldn't explain very well, and then we spend the rest of our lives sorting out, what is it that I did? And why do I think that this is true? But that doesn't make it irrational. I mean, most of the things we do in life are like that. Okay, but so what I would want to say is that the Spirit is essential. But in no way can I say to the unbeliever, well, there's no need for me to give you any sort of a defense for what I believe. The Spirit just has to tell you that it's true. That is not a biblical way to respond. Can I have this just one final snarky little comment? You'll see. This is my snarky little comment here. I want to go back to Jesus' statement to the Pharisees. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and you do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God? There is a modern version of that statement, I think, that Jesus could make in our day and age. And that is, how can you believe when you lust after academic respectability? Christians who are studying or teaching in the academic environment are under a great deal of pressure to succumb to this. It is clear, it is not acceptable to bring my Christian presuppositions about the nature of the world into many academic environments. I'm not saying that it can never happen, but it is hard to find those places where it can happen. And certainly there is this pressure. If you want to be accepted by us, if you want to be seen as one of the guys, then you're going to have to do your work in such a way that you leave that religious stuff at the door when you come in. And you play by our rules. And of course, when you play by our rules, God doesn't really enter into the conclusions, because our rules are you leave God out of your premises and then you won't have to mess with him in your conclusions. But if you play the game that way, we will bestow on you our approval. We say, yes, you are an academic, just as we are. Well, I mean, I know, it sounds, and I know I'm being snarky, but the fact is, I think that that pressure is huge. The pressure to want to belong, to want to be seen as respectable and intelligent and someone that ought to be taken seriously is a huge pressure. And so it's very relevant to the issue that we are talking about this week, because these questions of science, it is a community that has those sorts of pressures as well. We want to be people who have intellectual integrity. See, believing the gospel is a question of intellectual integrity. That is, of being willing to acknowledge that what is true is true. To be willing to acknowledge, I have been wrong. I have been very, very wrong in the way I have been looking at things. And we want to continue to have that sort of attitude. We want to believe what is true. We want to listen to other people so that if they have some way in which they have understood things better than we have, that we have the possibility of changing our minds. But we do not want to measure intellectual integrity by the applause of the academic community. And as tempting as it is to want to measure it that way, we as Christians have just got to stay away from that. Not in any sort of superior, I'm better than you sort of way, but just recognizing if the academic community is building on essentially mistaken premises in its leaving God out of it, the way it's coming to understand the world, then it can't help but go wrong somewhere in its conclusions, and we can't join them.
Talking about, just what we were talking about, how we've got our intellectual capacities and our reason, and the spiritual is essentially freeing our wills up, freeing our hearts up, if we put it that, to now not be resistant to this, these things that we should assent to. How do we, what does it mean to walk by the Spirit? Or, you know, how would you tell somebody, a Christian, as Paul says it, okay, what does Paul mean by that? How do I go about that this next week or this next year? What practical things would I actually do to do that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and one that has been a very important question to me and one I've wrestled with a lot. Let me tell you how I would answer that question right now. But I want to admit freely that the passages involved that talk about this sort of stuff are difficult passages, I think. So this is where I am right now and how I would look at it. I want to propose three different pictures. And I would like to say that the first one and the third one are both biblical ideas, and it's the one in the middle that I'm resistant to. Okay, on this side, we have a picture of the work of the Spirit, which is not at all susceptible to my, it's not something that I am bringing about. It is the Spirit blows where it wills and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So the sanctification that is happening in me is a result of the work of the Spirit. I didn't grab the Spirit as a tool to sanctify my heart. The Spirit is at work in me, and then you see the fruit of that in what comes out of my life. That's one picture. Over here on the other side, we have, I am a person with a mind and a heart and a will, and I have to choose how I'm going to live. I have to make these choices about what I believe and what I'm going to do and how I'm going to treat you and if I'm going to continue to pray to God or give up on Him and all of this stuff. And in a very real sense, it is up to me to make those choices. I mean, they're my choices to make. I have to make them. If I don't choose to do them, then I have chosen not to do them. And you know, so there's this task in front of me. The Spirit, then, in this way, sir, I look at the work of the Spirit of God and what the Spirit intends to accomplish in the world, and the work of the Spirit becomes for me then a goal. I want to be like that. I see the Spirit at work in the world to produce faith. I want to be a person of faith. The Spirit is the fruits of the Spirit, and love, peace, and joy, and all of those things. Those are the things that I should be pursuing. Okay. So, for example, at the very end of the passage in Galatians that talks about walking by the Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit, all of that stuff, Paul says, something about, my New American Standard translates it walk by the Spirit, I think, but it is really something like line up with the Spirit is what it means. It's a different phrase than he uses earlier when he talks about walking by the Spirit. And what he means is, it makes no sense for me to say I am a believer who is looking to the Spirit to make me a person like this, and then to be pursuing a life like this instead. If I'm looking to the Spirit for salvation, then I should be pursuing the things that I want to be saved to. Okay, so there's a biblical sense of walking by the Spirit means make it my goal to not forget and ignore what it is the Spirit of God is working in the world, but to pursue those things and to be a part of them. Okay? So, on the one hand, there's the Spirit is doing it totally apart from me. On the other hand, there's this, I must decide what sort of a life I'm going to choose. Now, ultimately, why is it that I choose to line up with the Spirit? It's because of this other one, because the Spirit is at work in me. But still, that choice is there for me to make. Now, what's the one in the middle? This is the one that I was taught when I was, first was a Christian. Jack was taught this stuff. I mean, we both had a lot of experience with this and wrestled with this stuff a lot. And this is that picture of, okay, the Spirit does this thing in me, but, of course, it takes me to grab the Spirit and make the Spirit do the right thing in me. The Spirit is this tool that I can use. So walking by the Spirit means then somehow it becomes this technique. When I go to do something, am I going to try to do it myself, is what I was taught, or am I going to walk by the Spirit? And somehow there are many different techniques and ways that people describe it, but somehow it comes down to this idea that there is something I can do to make what I am about to do more Spirit-filled than it would have been if I hadn't done that thing. And I know this is controversial, but I'm saying that category doesn't exist. That's not a biblical category. The Spirit is at work in me. I am, by the power of the Spirit, making those choices to pursue the things of the Spirit. But walking by the Spirit is not something that I need to find the way to make the Spirit do more in me. There is no technique like that. I just believe the gospel more is walking by the Spirit. So that's how I would answer that.
Could you go over what we were talking about, the Mormons, kind of, the burning in the bosom, or, ask yourself and let God reveal it to you. Mm-hmm. Their kind of mysticism in that compared to what you're suggesting. Just kind of another overview. I kind of got it, but make sure.
Well, let me make sure that I don't want to miscommunicate there. I had a certain thing in mind, and I don't have any objection. If a Christian said, someone was thinking about being a Christian, and they said, I'm going to pray to God and ask him to show me whether this is true or not, I wouldn't say, don't do that. That's what Mormons do. I mean, that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm saying, though, is what seemed to me to be what was happening in those situations when I encountered them is that was basically their move in answer to the objections that I would raise. I would say, well, but this doesn't make sense. You know, see how this is? And their answer is, well, just ask God to show you if it's true. That's what I'm saying. That's not the sort of thing that Christianity is. I can say, yes, by all means, ask God to show you whether it's true. Meanwhile, if you have a question about whether it's true or not, I may not know the answer, but I am quite convinced that it is true, and together we can find out, what's involved with this question that you're asking. Ultimately, there is coherence and inner consistency and intellectual integrity to a belief in God. So I'm not asking you to do something irrational. Stop thinking and start believing, which is kind of what I felt like the message I was getting from the Mormons was, is don't ask those questions, just ask God to show you what is true. I'm saying we can say to each other, basically, we have to understand how much the things we want to be true affect
what seems reasonable to us. So one of the things that I have to confront in myself is, am I willing to see the truth of things? But you're absolutely right that you shouldn't believe something that makes no sense. But we do have to ask the question, why doesn't it make any sense? I mean, there can be other reasons for why it doesn't make any sense than just it doesn't make any sense, if you know what I mean. I mean, sometimes I'm the one that's not making any sense. So, yeah, but I didn't mean that as an anti-mystical sort of statement, although nobody would accuse me of being a mystic, anybody who knows me, but that wasn't the thrust of what I was saying. What I'm concerned more with the idea that somehow we think of the spirit as this escape hatch we use to avoid actually having to have a reasonable way of thinking about things. And I feel like the Mormons were taking that escape hatch, and we as Christians don't need to take that escape hatch. That's what I was getting at.
Along the lines of that same question, what if you use that escape hatch because you don't know whether the thing you're talking about is true or not? Like, if it's a genuine question of, mm-hmm. I don't feel like God's given me enough tools to reason mm-hmm. through this thing, mm-hmm. like, I'm going to default to the escape hatch. You know, kind of this, like, isn't that how Aquinas was kind of using faith in that sense of sort of just, this is my default, I don't know where to go with this, I don't know how to reason it, so I'll just ask God to show me or something like that. Your advice to John's question was mm-hmm. instead of saying, use God as use mm-hmm. this escape hatch type mm-hmm. metaphor, mm-hmm. You would just say, well, we both are interested in truth, so let's try to reason it out together and really come to the crux of what it is your question is or what mm-hmm. you're trying to find out about God. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, what if you don't have the tools to tackle that specific issue, and you can't find anyone that does. It's like kind of like one of those big questions mm-hmm. that you're just really struggling mm-hmm. with.
Right.
I forgot my question.
Okay.
What do you do in that situation?
Right. Like, what about taking the escape hatch you were saying?
Yeah.
Well, there's so much involved. See, whenever I answer one of these questions, I have it focused on a particular kind of issue. It uh-huh. depends on what angle you're coming at it from as to what we're saying here. So, first of all, obviously, all of us are going to be in situations where we don't know how to answer some questions because none of us have put it all together. So I don't mean to suggest that if we just roll up our sleeves, we'll be able to figure out the answer to all questions. I don't believe that. Secondly, I don't want to miscommunicate. When I talk about reason, I don't mean, hey, we don't need the Bible. We could sit down and reason our way to figuring out that Jesus needed to die on the cross or something like that. I mean, I'm not pitting reason against revelation. It is reasonable for me to believe that there is a God, that he is good, and therefore to believe what he reveals to me about things that I never could have figured out myself. So much in the Bible is telling me things that it's not like I'm smart and I figured out that the gospel is true in that sense. The gospel is being presented to me and I'm going, oh, okay, now I understand it. I didn't get it before. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I don't mean reason to be this, God gave us this tool that is all we need to solve all problems and I'll just go in and solve all those problems because I'm a warrior of the intellect or something like that. I don't mean that either. I mean, I'm saying, but If the Bible tells me something that I couldn't have known or determined myself, it is still fundamentally reasonable. That is, it is reasonable for me to believe that God knows what he's talking about when he tells me what he's like, for instance, or something like that. And also, if he tells me something that doesn't seem to fit something else that I thought I had seen him tell me, then it's reasonable for me to say, maybe I made a mistake somewhere. Maybe I'm not understanding this right. Maybe I better think about this a little more. Maybe that's not what he's saying here. Maybe it's something else. All of that is an exercise of my mind in trying to deal with what it is that God has told me. And a lot of this is going to be, I mean, again, reason is not primarily about syllogistic reasoning. You know, start here with A, A implies B, and B implies C, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of it is just dealing with things that I understand very well and wrestling with my own will as to whether I'm going to submit to them or not. So it's not taking the escape hatch in what I'm saying to say to someone, I don't have an answer to your question. I don't know how to answer that. Giving them the best response that I have, saying it makes sense to me that there would be an answer to it, though. I mean, I encounter that sort of thing. I think the Bible teaches very clearly that the Bible is an absolutely authoritative revelation from God, that it is absolutely true in what it is affirming. When I have understood what the Bible is saying, what it's saying is true. And I think there's good reason to believe that. I couldn't tell you how that works out in every passage that there is in the Bible. People will point to Bible passages and say, well, that's a problem there. It seems to be saying something that's not true. And for some of those passages, I have an answer. For some of those passages, I don't have an answer. I say, well, you know, it does kind of look like that, doesn't it? But my meta answer, I would back up and say, but I think my confidence in God is well placed and my confidence in the Bible is well placed, and I have seen the Bible vindicate itself in many other situations, and this one I just don't know what to do with. So I admit it could be a problem, but I don't feel like it challenges the authority of the Bible, because I have plenty of good reason to think that the Bible is an authority. So I can say basically I think my basic answer to the non-Christian world is, as I look at the worldview that you're trying to live in, it is unlivable and you're refusing to admit it. You're denying your humanity in one way or another, and you think that somehow you're being real smart in doing it. The Christian worldview tells me who I am, explains my problem, tells me things about all sorts of aspects of my humanity and what I'm looking for in the world and the God who made the world in a way that just fits better than what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That's my basic answer to you. Now let's explore and see why that would be. But, you know, I'm not a Christian because I have a proof worked out for everything that the Bible says. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you, I've been there and I've been here, and this one is better. And so, you know, I think then it's an individual question of what particular problem does this person have? What's hanging them up?
Maybe I'm responding to a question you're not asking, so maybe this is irrelevant. But take the Mormon example. That my experience with Mormon missionaries and the passage they refer to is that the burning in the bosom is like asking God, I don't know what's true. Light my truth indicator light, and then I'll know. And so they're taking a physiological phenomenon that you're supposed to have as a truth indicator. Well, that escape hatch we should never take. Oh. I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, that nothing even remotely like that is ever justified. The way to come to terms with truth is to grapple with the evidence, including revelation, and try to understand it and make sense out of it and then come to know. And the other thing is, something that I think is feeding into that in Mormonism, and it feeds into that in all branches of Christianity as well, is our sense that we have to know the right answer to all the questions. We can never be agnostic. Well, on the view of faith that Ron was presenting today, there's nothing wrong with being agnostic about some things. If I don't know, it's because I don't know. And that's okay. I'm not going to be damned because I don't know. I'm going to be damned because I don't want to face the truth, if what Ron was saying is right. But if there's some lack of information or lack of experience or lack of something that means my knowledge has not come to fruition, then my knowledge hasn't come to fruition. I just don't know. That's okay. And we of all people should be free to admit that.
I think it can be very helpful to unbelievers for us to be forthright about what we feel confident we understand and what we don't. I mean, if we try to hide the fact that we don't have a very good answer, they can see that. You know, it's better to say, look, you know, I'm just like you. I know some things. I don't know some things.
I heard one apologist describe a difference between, that was helpful in his mind, between knowing something to be true and showing something to be true. That's always bothered me. It seems that there are some things that we have that we encounter in life that we know to be true that we haven't examined. And so in that sense, we haven't shown it, but it's something that is intuitive. But it also seems that when it come, if we take that route, that there are some things that we just know are true, that it seems to be that however you want to paint it and however you want to dress it up, it seems like the indicator light. Like, ding, I know it to be true. How would you address the points where in life there are some things that are on exam that we take for granted, like, I am real. I know it to be true, as opposed to showing, and how do you think through that?
Well, you're the one that talked about the indicator light, but so I have an answer to that, and then you can correct me and say what you were really getting at. But I think I could have said what Jack said about the indicator light, but I wouldn't have in saying we should never do that, I wouldn't mean that I should never say I just know that that's true, because I'm made that way. I mean, it's some of those things I was talking about earlier, like, you know, cause and effect and do I exist and all of that kind of stuff. I am made as a knowing person. And for somebody to challenge me and say, prove you exist, the fact that I'm not showing it, but I just know it, is not illegitimate. I would say the fact that you're trying to make me show such a thing shows that you're making a move on me that is illegitimate. I mean, that's not the way to do it. So some things need to be just known, and some things need to be shown. But the problem with that, the know it or show it kind of dichotomy, is I would say that there are other things that I know that I haven't explicitly shown, but they are nonetheless grounded in my rational process. This is Polanyi's kind of stuff, you know. That is, if you pushed me, I could start, together we could start to articulate, to show why I would think such a thing. But there are many things that I know because, like I said, I have confidence in my picture of the world, and this thing fits my picture of the world real well, and I've never really examined it closely, but it fits, and I believe it, and I'm right to believe it and to be confident in it. But intellectual integrity would say that if I was forced to, if I had to defend it, then, okay, so let's look at it and see. Why am I thinking that that's the case? So there's know it because you don't have to show it, and there's know it because it's reasonable, but you haven't shown it, but you could if you thought about it long enough, and then there's you need to show it. Does that make sense? Would you buy that? Does that?
Yeah. The last category. I mean, yeah. I make two categories: things that could never be shown because they are the foundation upon which everything that is shown, and it cannot itself be shown. It can only be practiced. We can't help ourselves. Foundational common sense. We just use it whether we like it or not, or whether we think it's justified or not. We're going, even if we attack it, we're going to use it to attack it. So there's just no getting around foundational intelligence and common sense. And then everything else, I think, is in principle showable. And some of those things we have shown, or to ourselves, other things we haven't shown yet, but they're in principle showable. I think where I get uncomfortable, and maybe this is what you're saying, where I get uncomfortable is where someone might stand up and say, I can't show it, but I just know it, therefore it's true. Well, that assumes the infallibility of my knowledge, and that's a faulty assumption. Polanyi, for example, is not saying that my intuitive, rational beliefs about reality are infallibly true, but it's self-correcting. When it's not true, I learn in time that it's not true, and having learned in time that it's not true, I then fix it, either by a wholesale paradigm shift or by an adjustment in my present paradigm. I fix it because I've, over time and experience, I learned that it's not true. So in principle, I don't have any problem with what he's saying, but if he makes the next move and says, I don't have to show it to you because I just know it, well, I don't just know it. So you are going to have to show it to me because you need to get me to a point where I know it too. And I can't just appeal to the authority of my own knowledge when I'm dealing with you. I need to show it. And if it is in principle showable, then that's not a legitimate, I mean, that's not an invalid thing to ask of someone or require of them. It only becomes invalid if they're asking me to show something that it makes no sense to have to show.
I probably made this clear, but, well, maybe I didn't. But when we talk about reason and faith and the knowledge of God and stuff like that, I don't want to imply, I don't at all have the picture that, for example, if you look at Aquinas and his five ways, you know, these different proofs for the existence of God and the ontological proof and all of those sorts of things. My feeling is when I read something like the ontological proof, I feel like I'm watching somebody do a magic trick in front of me. They're, you know, they hit a card in there somewhere and I haven't figured out where it is yet, but it's, you know, that's not compelling. I don't think that's what we mean by faith being reasonable, is I can come up with a Euclidean proof that demonstrates that it cannot be otherwise than true. That's not what we mean by reason around here. That's not what I mean at all. We don't live that way. And furthermore, I mean, that's the great thing about Polanyi's perspective is it, not that I understand it very well, but the what I do understand of it, what I like about it is that it allows that there is a necessary and appropriate subjectivity in my knowledge, and yet I am not skeptical about knowing things. And that's, it's to recognize subjectivity and not be skeptical, that's ultimately where I think, I mean, that's a biblical perspective on knowledge. So that's the sort of thing that we're talking about. It's not every Christian ought to be able to sit down and prove that, you know, somebody says, well, maybe, you know, I read this book that says this. They put some stuff on a sponge that they gave to Jesus that knocked him out, but he wasn't really dead. And then, so then he woke up in the tomb and he came out. How can you prove they didn't do that?
They didn't have sponges?
Yeah. I think there's a certain legitimacy to say, you got to be kidding me. Go away. That's not... You can't be serious about that, right? I mean, that is to say that I go back to what I said before. Our basic response is, as is true of all of the things that we believe, I believe that the gospel is true because of many explicit and intangible things that fit together to make the Christian worldview superior. And does that mean in any worldview that I have come to embrace, does that mean that I can come up with a proof for every aspect of what I believe? No. I mean, they can't do it either. I mean, if you want to push them, okay, so let's have your proof for, and then let's go through all of the things that they believe in their worldview. They can't really do that either. But that doesn't mean that their worldview or mine is illegitimate. That's not how we know things. I'm really getting in over my head. You should talk to Jack about this stuff. He has a PhD in philosophy. I don't know if you knew that. I do not have a PhD in philosophy. I do not have a master's degree in philosophy. They didn't talk about philosophy in my kindergarten. So,
that's it.